compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And good morning. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. As ever, I hope you enjoyed your 21-hour break. I ran out of time. I was like right at the end of the last phone call of the day yesterday, and I unfortunately didn't have enough time to give an adequate answer. That happens sometimes. So if that's happened to you, and maybe you called and you just didn't get enough time, if it's been a while anyway, we don't want, you know, we want to make the phone lines available for people who are calling in maybe for the first time too. But give me a call. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Two quick questions that have come in the last 24 hours. This one comes in from Jim, who says, Patrick, I just want to comment on the caller. And he wrote this yesterday after the show, I suppose. The caller who was upset that we don't say please as part of the Hail Mary. It wasn't actually the Hail Mary that he was worked up about. It was the Memorare. Remember, O Most Gracious Virgin Mary. But in any case, he says, I only caught the end of the call, but it sounded like he referred to our prayers as bombarding the Blessed Mother with our prayer requests. He did use that term. That's true. So Jim says, I think if he would examine that, it might help him to see that our prayers are not a burden. We are doing exactly what we are called to do. My understanding from listening to Relevant Radio is that the Rosary and the Chaplet of Divine Mercy were given to us through divine miracles. I thought you explained it well. This is just another angle. Well, it's a good angle, Jim. That's true. And it wasn't one of the points that he made that I really had time to sort of take up and discuss. I don't think he really, he didn't seem too interested in another point of view. But that's okay. You know, life is like that. And some things just strike people funny or the wrong way. And I guess we're all entitled to that. But you're right. Our prayers are by no means, you know, a bombardment on Mary. It's not like she's up there doing something important and we're pestering her. Like she's, come on, knock it off, guys. Could you just leave me alone? Can I just have some time to myself, please? She's not like that at all. She's not like you and I are, quite frankly. Cyrus, you've never done that, right?
Not
you've
me.
Never snarled at your kids. Can you just give me some peace and quiet? You've never done that, have you?
That's definitely not me.
No. You're not the snarling kind. I've gotten to know you, and I've never seen you snarl. Unless you do it behind my back, which when I leave the room, maybe when that's when it happens. I don't know. But Our Lady is certainly not like that, nor are any of the saints or angels. They love us, and they're, as it says in Hebrews chapter 12, that they're like a cloud of witnesses up there. You might think of them as cheering you on, and so they're avidly interested in helping you with their prayers. Second email that came in, this is from Amy. And she says, you were talking about illicit verbiage used by some priests during the Mass and whether or not it invalidates the Mass or the consecration. One of our priests, instead of saying, wash away my iniquities and cleanse me from my sin, says, wash away my sinfulness and cleanse me from my shame. Does this in any way invalidate the consecration? Amy asks. Well, thankfully, happily, no. On the negative side, it's a shame, quite frankly, when, you know, a priest decides that he knows better than the church what should be said. He doesn't, by the way. And when he customizes the Mass to suit his own whims and preferences, that's a real shame. That is illicit, meaning that it is unlawful for him to do that, and there are various degrees of gravity of illicitity, but that's on him. Now, it would detract from the experience that you might have at the Mass because you're there expecting the Mass to be celebrated according to the liturgical books, according to the 2,000-year wisdom and contemplation and insight and theological knowledge of the Church. That's what you would expect. So it's unfortunate, to say the least, when a priest takes it upon himself to customize the Mass, which he shouldn't do, but that does not invalidate the Mass in any way. The only part of the Mass that is subject to a question of validity would be in the Eucharistic sacrifice. So the liturgy of the Eucharist, or the second half of this Mass, which is sort of seen as two distinct halves of one thing. It's not two separate things, but one thing. But the second half, the liturgy of the Eucharist, is where during the consecration, the priest says those all-important words of consecration. And they can actually be reduced to the most important part in terms of what is actually necessary for validity was the priest to say, this is my body and this is my blood. Now, he should use, of course, the prescribed form that's in the liturgical books, the various canons of the Mass. But if he were to use a different formula there, and or if he used invalid matter, like let's say instead of an unleavened wheat host, let's say he used or tried to use a peanut butter cookie or a potato chip, that would be invalid. That would be invalid. Or if he said something other than, when he got right down to that point, this is my body and this is my blood. If he said, this symbolizes my body, or this will make you remember my body or something, that would be invalid. So that's where the question of validity or invalidity comes in with regard to customizing different parts of the Mass where he shouldn't do that. That's a separate category, as I mentioned. That's illicit, meaning it's unlawful, but that doesn't affect you in any way. It doesn't affect the validity of the Holy Eucharist. And I hope that that helps, and I hope it's an encouragement to you. 888-914-9149. Let's start off with Vincent now, waiting patiently in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Good morning, Vincent. I can't even say the words today. Good morning.
Good morning. I think that the real battle against abortion is just beginning in some states. I called an elderly aunt by marriage yesterday that she's in her 70s, just to say hello and see how she's doing. And she's often teased me over the years about, we cancel each other out at the ballot box. I'm pretty conservative and she's a flaming liberal. And I'm Catholic and grew up Anglican, and she belongs to what she calls an all-inclusive Lutheran church. I don't even know what that means. But she started ranting and raving at me about what my people have done to this country in the overturning of Roe versus Wade. There are going to be dead bodies in alleyways, and she's all beyond pro-choice, just ruining young people's lives. And I've worked in veterinary medicine all my life, and I tried to explain calmly that, let's say my dog was pregnant and I didn't want the puppies, and I had them destroyed before they were born, she would probably think I was the meanest person in the world, and yet she thinks that's fine for human beings, and she won't admit that abortion is murder.
So are you asking me how can you talk to her, or how can you reason with her?
Yes. What's...
Well, this is, to my mind, this is an example of what I think Jesus had in mind when he sent out his disciples, you know, to all the cities and towns out there. And he said, when you go into a town and they receive you, go and stay at the house that you're offered lodging at and, you know, eat your meals there and then preach the gospel. He said, but if you go into a town, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, if you go into a town and they won't listen to you, then just move on. He said, just move on. Just shake the dust from your feet and go to the next town. In other words, you're not obligated to stand there endlessly trying to get it through somebody's thick skull that killing innocent, unborn human beings is wrong. And if they just simply won't or can't admit it or see it or whatever, I would just simply move on. Now, I realize that she's your auntie and you have a family relationship with her, but heaven's sakes, you know, if it's that unpleasant and every time you talk to her, she's that mean-spirited and vicious and nasty, etc., I would just move on personally. Hey, have a nice life. And by the way, I really hope this whole pro-choice thing works out for you in the end. I don't think it's going to. I think that when the time comes and you have to meet Jesus face-to-face and give him an account of your life, this is going to come up. This is going to be a line item on his clipboard. Bullet points, things that he wants to talk to you about, this is going to be on there. So lots of luck. I would just simply move on. I maybe it's because the older I get, the more I realize the truth. And, you know, life is too short. And so wrangling and finagling with her and all that, if it's gotten you nowhere all these years, I would just say, have a nice life. I love you. I'll pray for you. And Be well. That's what I would say.
Well, what amazes me is that there are women who are over 50. They have three children, four children. They know how it works, and yet they're pro-abortion.
I know. It's a strange phenomenon. There are people who believe the earth is flat. There are people who believe, take your pick. There are all kinds of crank theories out there. This is just another one of them. It just happens to get people killed, though. And it's possible, Vincent, I don't know. It's possible that your aunt had an abortion. And this may very well be why she is so ferocious on this topic. And as human beings often are, we rationalize our sin if we can. And one way to do that is to say, well, I didn't do anything wrong, and it's legal. And look, other people are doing it, and I'm going to fight for their right to do it. And it's a way of trying to assuage one's guilty conscience. Now, I don't know if your aunt had an abortion, but given the countless millions of abortions that have taken place in this country since Roe versus Wade, and given her age, I mean, she was in prime time during the 1970s, when she would have been a young woman, very possibly getting pregnant. You know, I don't know her story. But the point is, that may well be the root cause of it. So my advice would be, move on, express your kind sentiments to her, pray for her. Don't neglect to pray for her, and love her from a distance. But it seems as though there's so much wear and tear here that it's not really worth your time to try to do that. If you haven't been successful thus far, leave it in God's hands is what I would say. Thanks, Vincent. Let's go to Maggie now in Chicago. Good morning, Maggie. I'm told that you are 14. Is that correct?
Hi, yes.
Well, welcome.
So my question is, why did Jesus or God put us on this earth if he knew, like, Satan was here first? And, like, why would he put us in harm's way?
This is a good question. It's a mysterious question because you and I would reason this way as human beings. We would say, if it were, let's just talk about our children, right? You're too young to have children yet. But when the time comes, if I knew that there was a snake in the backyard, I wouldn't let my kids go play in the backyard. You know, if it was like a rattlesnake or a cobra or something, if I knew that there was some dangerous creature in the backyard, I wouldn't let my children go play in the backyard. It seems like really basic logic that anybody would use. I would say that, and I'm sure you would too. But this was different because in order for Adam and Eve to have a test, there had to be the temptation that would question whether or not they were going to pass the test. The temptation that would introduce in their minds, do I do what God wants or do I do what I want? So the nature of the fall of Adam and Eve, and certainly God was aware that the serpent was in the garden. He was aware that the evil one was present, but it was part of his plan for Adam and Eve to have their test. So knowing that, of course, God knows everything, anything that can be known, God knows. So he knew, obviously, what was going to happen, but it was for the purposes of Adam and Eve to face this test and then either pass it or fail it, and they failed it, of course. And that was the role, you might say, that the evil one, Satan, the devil, the serpent, that he played. So the reason I say this is mysterious is because unlike our human logic, God has a super logic that's way above us that we have many times no way of really understanding. And because he sees things all at once and he sees the entire plan of his providence all at once, in his view, he can see why having this happen the way it did was important, necessary, the right way to go, the right thing to do. There are different ways that we can describe it. We're looking at it from our standpoint saying, I wouldn't do that if I were in that position. So the best we can do is to say, knowing that God is all loving, he's all knowledgeable, he's all powerful, the fact that he permitted this to happen this way tells us, even if we don't understand it, that this is the best way it could have happened. That God did things, you know, knowing how it would turn out. And it's a mystery for us, but we try to ponder it nonetheless. So those are my thoughts. Maggie, what do you think about that?
That makes a lot of sense, so thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're very welcome. Well, I hope you'll call again, and I appreciate that. Thank you. There you go. I think Maggie just dropped. I was going to ask Maggie if she understood that. Let me hear that again. Yeah. Only people of a certain age are going to get that, or regular listeners of the Patrick Madrid Show.
There you go.
Or Maggie, who works in our studio. She'll get that. She's probably laughing right now. Yeah. She's probably laughing right now. Hey, Maggie, shout out down the hall. Let's go to Marta now in Philadelphia. Hello, Marta.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to call in today because I have a question. I had a situation yesterday as well. I work in a hospital, and I often come across patients I often come across patients who are in their last hour, mm-hmm. Getting ready to pass away. I have a devotion to the Divine Mercy Chaplet. I pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet for, we were a Catholic hospital, mm-hmm. For our Catholic patients. Also, we have Jewish patients, of course, of all, you know, denominations that come to the hospital. But yesterday in particular, we had a Jewish patient who passed. And I wanted to pray the Divine Mercy. And I thought to myself, I should, but he's Jewish. Would it be a benefit to his soul to go to heaven?
1,000,000%, obviously.
Yeah.
Remember, think about this, Marta. First of all, in Romans chapter 1, St. Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. And that phrase should be emblazoned in my mind, in your mind, in everyone's mind. You know, don't be ashamed of the gospel. That the gospel is salvation in Jesus Christ. Remember what he said. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And he was speaking to Jews. He was a Jew. He was speaking to Jews, and he was telling them, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So Jesus himself emphasized repeatedly that there is only salvation in him. There is no other salvation. And he was the fulfillment of all the promises that were made to the Jews, waiting for their Messiah. God sent the Messiah. God came to us as the Messiah in Jesus. And so, yes, I mean, 100,000,000,000%, yes, these people absolutely need to hear about Jesus and have an opportunity for salvation. And it may be in God's providence that from all eternity, he has planned that you would be in that room with those people at that time for that reason. So I would never recommend being pushy or anything like that. And you don't sound like the pushy kind of person. I'm sure you're very sweet and gentle. But by no means should you be ashamed of the gospel. They need to hear, even if, you know, maybe they're not in a position to communicate at that point, but they need to hear that message, even if it's in their last hour. And so by all means, praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet, having a picture of Jesus, talking about Jesus, would you like me to pray for you? You know, Jesus loves you and you can be saved if, you know, would you like to be baptized? I mean, there's so many things you could do in that extreme moment. And I would say, don't hesitate to try to do something and ask the Lord, Lord, in this moment, what would you have me do? What would be the most efficient way to help this person come to salvation? So I would very much encourage you to make Beautiful. Use of those opportunities, you know?
Yes. Yes, I often have the cards in my purse, and I always put the image of the Divine Mercy in mm-hmm. in their room, facing them, and
yeah.
hoping that the Lord looks upon them with all the mercy.
He does. He does indeed, and he loves them, and that may very well be why you're in the room with them, because he loves them, and he's sending someone to them to help them prepare for death and come to faith in Christ. Thanks, Marta. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
connected to the conversation, call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Let me tell you the thing about this guy that you're hearing playing bass right now. His name is Charles Berthoud. I don't know how he pronounces it. Berthoud. He looks to me like he's about, what would you guess, maybe 21, 22?
Early 20s.
Yeah, early 20s. And, oh, I what I was going to say about this guy is that he would blow the doors off of Paul McCartney. And Paul McCartney's a really good bass player. Yeah.
What? Oh, Paul McCartney's good?
He's a really good bass player, but he ain't nothing compared to this guy.
This guy's next level.
And what makes it so frightening is that, you know, like so many people would like to be as good. They're trying to claw their way up to being as good as Paul McCartney is. But this guy is so far beyond that. So I'm really glad that we discovered him because he adds a nice vibe to the music for the show.
Yeah, he's incredible. If you want to look him up and you can't remember how Patrick just spelled it, just YouTube, Google redhead bass guy. It's the first thing that pops up.
So he's getting well known enough that even without a name, you can find him. Yeah, it's quite phenomenal. Just I've never seen anything like it. He's a prodigy. Let's go to E. Frank now in Astoria, New York. E. Frank, you and I have spoken a few times, and I've never asked you this question. What kind of a name is E. Frank? Is E like the initial, or is it part of, is it like all one word, E. Frank? Or can you tell me the background on the name?
Yeah, it happened to be that I was born in the City Hospital, New York City, back in 1970. And my father's name was similar, but they decided to use a African-American Islamic prophet to describe my birth, so they named me that.
Oh, so is the E the like your the initial of your first name, and Frank is your middle name?
No, it's an entire name.
I got it. Okay. Yeah, I never really understood it. I've never seen that before, and other than you. So I thought there must be some story behind it. Now I know.
Well, hi. You know, Patrick, I've always been curious about this because I remember back in when I was receiving my first Holy Communion, because I did receive my first Holy Communion with Mickey Rooney's niece, Veronica, and with Bugsy Siegel's niece, granddaughter, I believe.
You move in interesting
May
circles.
13th, 1978, in the Diocese of Brooklyn. Okay. And I always wondered at that time, who was the individuals or bishops that were in charge of dictating policy in the United States? Is it individual parishes, archdiocese, a diocese, or the United States of Conference of Catholic Bishops?
What kind of policy do you have in mind? Can you give me an example?
Yes. Do the bishops, are they like the head bishop of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, is he appointed by the Pope, or is, as I said to your call screener, is he, are they elevated and placed there through merit from their past work in, let's say, local dioceses or parishes? Because I never understood what the Conference of Catholic Bishops here in the United States actually does.
Okay, so the answer is neither, at least with regard to those two options. It's the president, that's the name of the office. He's not the head bishop. He's the president of the bishop's conference, and every country has a bishop's conference. So he is elected. So every X number of years, and I don't know how long they serve their term for. It might be 6 years, might be 4 years. I'm not entirely sure. I'd have to check. But for a certain period of time, whoever is elected as president and also vice president, and they have other, you know, committee chairmanships and things like that. So it's simply a vote that's taken. And there are different bishops whose candidacies are raised, you know, they're put forward. Would you be willing to run if you know, in the next election? Sure, I'll be willing to run. Or no, I'd rather not run. So when they have a slate of candidates who would be willing to run, then there's a vote taken. And the vote determines who is elected president, etc. Now, as I understand it, I believe that that has to be signed off on by the Pope. The Pope doesn't appoint them, but I think the Pope has some role in approving somebody who is a man who is elected to that position. But even that may not be the case. I'm not sure about that. That would be a rule that's arcane enough that I just don't know it. But I do know that they are elected. That's how they get into office.
Do they have any say in local dioceses or archdioceses or local parishes?
Well, the Bishop's Conference is not an authoritative body. It's a consultative body. It's a body that is intended for the bishops of the country to be, you know, to have the ability to, among themselves, discuss aspects of the church, the faith in America. But from a legal standpoint and a pastoral standpoint, the bishop has authority in his diocese. And so the bishops' conference, they can jointly issue statements. There was a time, I remember it well, in the 80s, and they were issuing statement after statement after statement that was like nobody was reading it, and it was on, in some cases, on issues that seemed very outside of their scope of influence. But in any case, the U.S. Bishops' Conference nowadays, I think, is much more on point and much more focused on issues that really pertain to the ministry of the bishop, and I'm glad of it. But they don't dictate policy. The local bishop is the one who's in charge of what will happen in his diocese. They consult and they issue sort of joint statements as a show of unity often, but even there, not all the bishops in a given bishops' conference would agree on certain things. So when it comes to things like how are things done in a diocese, ultimately that's the decision or the authority of the bishop. But that also is extended to the parish level. So the parish priest, and in particular the pastor of the parish, he has a certain set of responsibilities but also rights and duties. And so he too would have a say at the local level in things like what time are we going to have Mass on Sunday? That's up for him to decide. The bishop's not going to decide that for him. Or if the priest wants to have a certain kind of music or other things that are within his purview, he has the authority to make those decisions. So it's under the bishop and in concert with him, but that authority is delegated down. I hope that's helpful, Frank. I appreciate the call. 888-914-9149. Now, I want to raise an issue here. We haven't really talked about this much since the leak of the Supreme Court Justice Alito's opinion, the majority opinion, that will, God willing, effectively overturn Roe versus Wade. We talked a little bit about the aftermath of this release and some of the violence that was perpetrated. Thankfully, from what I can tell, it was a pretty minimal amount of violence, but violence at some Catholic churches. There have been protests, and I have an article here from Axios that is all about the potential for violence. I want to share this with you in hopes that it won't happen, but if it does, I'd like you to be aware of some of the things to be cognizant of. And by the way, my phone number is 888-914-9149. If you want to call now, we do have some lines open, so this is a good time to get in. 888-914-9149. This is again from Axios. The U.S. government is bracing for a potential surge in political violence once the Supreme Court hands down the ruling that's expected to overturn Roe versus Wade, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Now, this is a memo that was leaked. All kinds of leaking going on. The big picture: law enforcement agencies are investigating social media threats to burn down or storm the Supreme Court building and murder justices and their clerks, as well as attacks targeting places of worship and abortion clinics. Now, I will add a little footnote to this of my own, and that is that because five of the Supreme Court justices, including those that were of the majority opinion, because they are Catholic, there's a particular ire, there's a particular opprobrium that is being directed at the Catholic Church. And just be aware that when they talk about places of worship, they're not talking about mosques and synagogues. They're not talking about, you know, necessarily anyway, your local Lutheran or Presbyterian church. Primarily, at least in terms of what's being said on social media, they're talking about Catholic churches, specifically Catholic. The unclassified May 13th memo by the Department of Homeland Security Intelligence, its intelligence arm, says the threats that followed the leak of the draft opinion targeting Supreme Court justices, lawmakers, and other public officials, as well as clergy and healthcare providers, are likely, and this is a quote from the memo, are likely to persist and may increase leading up to and following the issuing of the court's official ruling. Abortion-related violence historically has been driven by anti-abortion extremists. Well, that's debatable. Some racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists' embrace of pro-life narratives may be linked to the perception of wanting to save white children and fight white genocide. The memo warns that this time extremist acts could come from abortion rights proponents as well. Well, trust me on this one, guys. When Roe versus Wade is overturned, you're not going to see people on the pro-life side burning down buildings and smashing police cars and attacking other people. It'll be a time of gratitude. Finally, we have overcome. Doesn't mean abortion is over, obviously. There's always that one person. Well, that doesn't mean that abortion will be over. That just means it's going to go back. Yes, of course. Everyone knows that. Calm down. Like, I hate to break it to you, Chad, but everybody knows that when Roe versus Wade is overturned, it doesn't mean that abortion magically goes poof and it's gone. We all understand that. Settle down. But the violence that is going to erupt, should it erupt, I hope it doesn't, but I fear it will, is going to be coming from the left. Now ask yourself this question. Why would you be surprised if people on the left, who already are extremely verbally violent, it doesn't mean that there aren't some people on the right who are too, there are, that's for sure, but the left has a certain penchant for verbal violence when it comes to shouting down people, trying to eat in restaurants, just trying to mind their own business. And
so don't mess with me when it comes to words like that.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Although that's a very tame example. Ask yourself this question. If somebody is already at the point, you know, the stage four part of this lunacy, where they countenance and even demand and celebrate and insist upon the killing of unborn innocent human beings, why on earth would you think that they wouldn't be willing to be violent? I mean, they're already applauding and standing up for and fighting for violence in the form of killing unborn human beings. So why would it surprise anybody that these same people who are already in the stage four stage of their mental illness in terms of being willing to do this, why wouldn't they be willing to do something more, like go out in the streets and start attacking people? It could happen. It's happened before. So, in response to a request for a comment, a Department of Homeland Security spokesman said that the department is committed to protecting Americans' freedom of speech and other civil rights and liberties, including the right to peacefully protest. I sure wish they would emphasize peacefully. The memo says the DHS is also committed to working with our partners across every level of government and the private sector to share timely information and intelligence, prevent all forms of violence, and to support law enforcement efforts to keep our communities safe. Well, I'm happy about that. They say in the article that the Roe decision is flypaper for extremists. The memo, along with, by the way, you're not an extremist if you believe that Roe versus Wade was a terrible decision. You're not an extremist if you believe that we should do whatever we can to safeguard the most vulnerable among us, the elderly, the ill, unborn. All of those who are vulnerable groups deserve our protection. That is not extremism. And if you pray a rosary in front of an abortion clinic, you are not an extremist. You know what you are if you do that? If you pray the rosary in front of an abortion clinic, or if you participate in 40 Days for Life, or if you help out at a women's pregnancy center, or you're helping to take care of moms and their kids, as many pro-life people do after the babies are born, you're not an extremist. You know what you are? You're a normal, good person. That's what you are. If you are aghast at the way in which half of this country is so ferociously defending the idea of perpetuating abortion, you're not an extremist. They are, you're not. So check out this article. And, you know, why was this memo leaked? Well, Could be, because they want the public to have sort of a head start in being aware that this could erupt. Now, we saw what happened after the murder of George Floyd 2 years ago, coming up on the second anniversary. You saw the rioting and the violence and the fury and the paralysis in the case of many police departments where they didn't know what to do or they just did nothing. And, of course, the nonsense about defunding the police departments and all the things that took place in the wake of that. We've already seen that in recent memory. We've seen it. This, you know, I deplore the murder of George Floyd, certainly. But this is on a far vaster scale. Abortion affects this country in so many ways. There's so much money involved. There's so much political influence that is involved. There are a lot of guilty consciences that are involved. So let us pray. If ever there was a time to pray for peace, let us pray for peace now in anticipation of the release of this ruling. We're going to take a break. I'm going to come back to you and take your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. Also, I've got some TikTok stuff to share with you, not only about some of the pro-abortion people, but also about some other people who are just trying to get some clicks. That's all they want. They just want to get some clicks. They want some followers. And they've gone to a whole new level of stupid to try to do that. I'll share with you what that is right after this.
Hey, there's a line open. So now is your opportunity to ask Patrick a question by calling 888-914-9149.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149.
Yeah.
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
Yeah.
Relevant Radio.
Oh, yeah. 888-914-9149. We'll go to Dave now in Miami. Hello, Dave. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. God bless you. And I wanted to make an observation about the pro-abortion side.
Okay.
Just recently, I had parked my car and walked out on the street to return to a party I was at. Actually, it was my grandson's baptismal party. And I found myself in the middle of a pro-abortion demonstration. They were walking down the streets, mm-hmm. chanting and with the very, very vulgar signs. And I just reached into my pocket. I'm not somebody that's ever been to a, you know, abortion clinics and praying the rosary. But I, in such a situation, I just found myself grabbing my rosary out of my pocket and just standing in the middle of these people as they poured down the street, just praying the rosary quietly, looking at them, sometimes looking up, sometimes looking down. Mm-hmm. And as I noticed these people, to me, I was just taken by the anger, the confusion, the frustration, and the incredible vulgarity of them, even with children in their midst, just awful, terrible, vulgar things. And I found that my prayer at that time was that God would soften their hearts. Somehow, some way, these people, there's no logic, there's no reason. It's just these people have their hearts hardened, and somehow by the will of God their hearts must soften so that this thing doesn't spin out of control. I just want to make that comment.
That's a good point. Proverbs 15:1 says, "A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger." And you saw both sides of that. So you were giving the proverbial soft answer by your presence there, and they were basically fulfilling the harshness and anger that gets stirred up when you do what they're doing. Another proverb that comes to mind is Proverb 29:11. A fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man quietly holds it back. And I sure know which one you were in that moment.
I was doing my best, you know, and I found myself as I heard them, I was like, I wanted to rush into the spiritual battle. I was like, oh, this is it. This is a spiritual battle. I got to get out there. And before I actually ran out there, I found myself, wait a second, here, slow down, cowboy. And just like David going into battle, he always offered it up to the Lord first about what should I do? How should I do this? And I made a little prayer about what do you want for me right now, God? And I just whipped out the rosary and started praying it like on the sidewalk, and they were walking down the street and the sidewalk, and so I was very visible. I was the only person, you know, at that particular point praying and offering anything up for the pro-life side. And the response to me was limited. It's not like people pushed me or shoved me, but there were comments that you just hear the anger. Yeah. Get out of here. You don't belong here.
Yeah.
And
they probably added an extra word or two here and there when they said, get out of here. But I know what you mean. And who knows, Joe, maybe your presence there, your calm composure might have had a positive effect on somebody. Sometimes it does. But with things poised to become potentially, at least, far more violent, I would suggest that in the future, maybe that's not the best place to go, especially if these people are gathering and milling around and, you know, their fury is rising. I'm reminded of a totally different kind of scenario, Joe, but I'll just take your mind back or cast your mind back to the L.A. riots in the aftermath of the Rodney King verdict that exonerated the white police officers. Remember Rodney King and that beat down and all that back in the 90s? I don't know if Joe's still there. Maybe he's not. Well, thanks for the call, Joe. I appreciate it. Well, what happened there was there were full-scale riots in Los Angeles. And there were people who were just, you know, killing indiscriminately. There we go. Thank you, Cyrus. So 1992. And we watched it on TV in Southern California, not terribly far away from where it was happening. It was surreal to watch this. And just buildings torched. There were plenty of, seems like the liquor store owners, many of them, they stayed behind to defend their stores. And that was a real fiasco. A lot of people, you know, got hurt and people died, as a matter of fact. But there was this one guy, and I'd never met him, but I knew who he was. It was a Protestant preacher guy, and his name was Wally Tope, T-O-P-E. I never met him, but I read some of his stuff. I disagreed with much of what he believed as a Protestant, because he, you know, biblically wrong, if you ask me. But I have to give him credit in a certain sense. I mean, in a way, I'll give him some credit, and that is that in the midst of the worst rioting in the streets of Los Angeles, where it was an absolute free-for-all, and law enforcement wasn't or couldn't do anything. Daryl Gates was the police chief. I think he had them stand down. But it was just absolute free-for-all, bricks flying, people being dragged out of cars and beaten to death, buildings being torched. I mean, we watched it all on television. If you're old enough to remember, you remember this. This guy, Wally Tope, he gets a handful of Bible tracts, and he goes right down in the middle of this maelstrom of violence and fury and looting and all that stuff. He goes in the middle of this, and he's like, he's trying to hand people Bible tracts. And they killed him. And it didn't do any of them any good. So the reason I'm mentioning that sad situation is he was naive. He was good-hearted, and I pray that he had, you know, I pray that he died in the state of grace, and I hope I see him in heaven. I've never met him, so I'll have to have somebody introduce. Hey, by the way, Patrick, you used to talk about that guy Wally Tope on the show back when you were on Earth. Well, here he is. I'd like to meet him. That'd be interesting. But boy, was it foolhardy to do what he did. He wasn't doing himself any good. He wasn't doing his cause any good. He wasn't doing those people any good. It was a, you know, an understandable effort on his part, but he chose the wrong time and place to do it. And he died as a result. Somebody bashed his head in with a rock or a brick or something like that. He did not live long. So look him up, Wally Tope, and remember him so that if it should happen that things get weird and they very possibly could. I hope they don't. Let's pray that they don't. But if they do, be, as Jesus said, wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Be wise, be prudent. And this is what our caller was talking about. He didn't use the term prudence, but that's a virtue. The virtue of prudence is where you know by this virtue what is the right thing to do in a given situation. And sometimes the right thing to do is not get in the middle of something, because it can be, well, think about Wally Tope. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Joe in Warranty, Philadelphia. Hello, Joe. What do you know?
I'm in Warrington.
Warrington. Oh, I'm sorry. It says warranty. Like, you have a warranty on your car. Anyway,
and
sorry, Joe. Welcome.
Probably my, could, with my accent, I'm sure. I have had two quick questions. First one is, why do we call Jesus Jesus and not Emmanuel? Because in the Old Testament, they say his name will be Emmanuel.
Yeah. Well, his given name was Yeshua. Now, where it says Emmanuel, that's more of a title because it means God is with us. Now, it doesn't mean that's not also a name, but it seems clear that because Jesus growing up, being called Jesus or Yeshua, that was the name that people understood that he went by. Now, Wonderful Counselor, Prince of Peace, Emmanuel, God is with us. The Son of Man, the Son of God, the Christ, these are all ways of referring to him, but none of those were his given name. Even though it says his name shall be called Emmanuel, it apparently, or obviously, I guess, wasn't intended to be understood that that was literally his given name. That's the best I can do on that one.
Okay. All right. The other one is, I was always taught there was a major difference between Jesus rising from the dead and some people say he was raised from the dead. And recently I've listened to the Enacted Apostle. Paul says that he was raised, but I thought he rose on his own. So
he did. So he did. So he rose on his own. So Jesus, being God, rose under his own power. He also ascended to the Father under his own power. But the Bible also refers to how God raised him from the dead. And this is a reference to the incarnation. So as a human, Jesus, as he's a divine person with a divine nature, obviously, but he took to himself a human nature in its complete form. So a human mind, human will, human body, etc. So that part of Christ was sort of, you might say, the instrument that God used to, in the incarnation, to be with us here on earth, talk to us, teach us, etc. That's a creature. So our Lord's human nature is a creature. It is a creation of God. And so when we talk about Jesus rising from the dead, we can understand that to mean that he, as a divine person, he rose from the dead under his own power, which he did. But it's also true to say that he was raised from the dead if by he, it's referring not to the person so much, but the human nature. The human nature, being a creature, was not capable of rising under its own power. Only a person could do that. And so God, in essence, raised the humanity of Jesus from the dead. So it's a distinction that's important, but it is very subtle, as you can see. The two are referring to the same thing, and one does not cancel out the other, I guess is the best way I could put it.
You know, the answer to that question brings up something else. I don't know if you have time for one other question. But
sure. I have about enough time for maybe one quick one.
Okay. A priest, when we were on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, raised the question raised the possibility that Jesus didn't know that he was God when he was initially born, but that he grew into that knowledge as he went through his ministry. Is that possible?
Well, yes and no. But let me put it this way. Jesus is a divine person, and he has a divine nature. And so as a person, he is the subject of the two natures that he has, divine and human. So in his divinity, Jesus knows all things. He's God. So there's nothing that can be known that Jesus doesn't know. Excuse me. So from the very moment of the incarnation, the moment of his conception, as God, Jesus, of course, knew all of this. There was never a chance of that not happening. We're told in Luke's gospel, excuse me, with a frog in my throat. We're told in Luke's gospel that after the finding in the temple, when the boy Jesus, about 12 years old, was reunited with his family, we're told he went back with them to Nazareth, and there he grew in knowledge and wisdom. That's referring to his human knowledge. Now, what's interesting, and this is what St. Thomas Aquinas says on this point, Joe, is that it is true. Jesus had to learn how to walk. He had to learn how to tie his sandals. He had to learn how to talk. He had to learn the languages of the era, of that area. So in his humanity, he did learn all those things. But the thing to remember is, because his human nature was perfectly united with his divine nature, Jesus always, in his humanity, always had the beatific vision. From the very beginning, he saw God face to face from the very beginning, always. So that illumination and the infused knowledge that Jesus had from the moment of his conception leads me to say what St. Thomas said, and that is, yes, he always knew. There was never a time that he didn't know that he was the Messiah, the Savior, that he was God. But I have to leave it at that. Thanks, Joe. I'm coming back with hour two right after this.